Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we talk about things like salt damage, perhaps, in your yard and your garden. What about your woody ornamentals? How are they doing? Do you need to do some pruning? All those things and a whole lot more we can visit with Laura Joe about. She's back with us, professor and extension specialist for woody ornamentals in the Department of Horticulture at UW-Madison. So what questions do you have maybe about winter burn or perhaps pruning or maybe salt damage? Give a call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post a Twitter note to us as well, The Larry Mueller Show. Laura Joe with us by phone. Hi, Laura. Thank you for taking time to come along today.
Well, it's good to be on your show, Larry. Thanks.
Always nice to have you with us. What about salt? What can rock salt do to the soil in your yard and garden?
Well, rock salt, or sodium chloride, is what is commonly used on our streets throughout Wisconsin. And though it is effective at melting snow and ice, but at very cold temperatures below zero, or actually below about 10, 15 degrees, it doesn't work as well. And it does hurt our roads, of course. However, it does cause more damage to plants than anything. And the sodium chloride, the rock salt, the sodium ion itself is really bad for soil. It can replace calcium in the soil, and it causes severe compaction of soil. It does a lot of things to plants as it themselves, and you can see discoloration of, especially along the margins of the leaf. Delayed bud break, off-colored leaves, plants may not flower, crowns of the plant become thin, and really there's other abiotic and biotic diseases that can affect plants that look, symptoms look like salt injury. But one of the classic symptoms is on like a white pine that's really sensitive to road salt. The side of the tree right next to the road, especially in spring, you'll see brown needles. But the other side of the plant that's facing away from the road will often still have green needles, and that's classic salt spray injury.
Yeah, so it just sprays up from the plows or whatever and lands on the needles and sort of maybe desiccates them, or what is it?
Yeah, it dries out the leaves. The chloride ion draws the moisture out of the leaf. If it's an evergreen, if it's deciduous, it can actually kill buds. And some plants, actually, I have a UW Extension publication on the Learning Store. If you Google Learning Store Extension, it should come up. And it's on, the title of the publication is Winter Salt Injury and Salt-Tolerant Landscape Plants. And I discuss the types of salt injury, the symptoms. I also list prevention methods as well as salt-tolerant plants. And there's some. There's not a lot, but there are some that can tolerate a little bit more salty diet.
Is that right? Which would those be? Get at least a few.
The plants?
Yeah, the salt-tolerant ones.
Ginkgo is one. Our native honey locust is another. Kentucky coffee tree. In terms of shrubs, we have our native black chokeberry. Our sumacs are very salt tolerant.
Oh.
And all of them are native. And that's why you often see them on the side of highways. They can tolerate those conditions, but they do spread quite readily.
Yeah. What can, in terms of prevention, are there some things? You know, it's pretty tough if you've got plants right along the roadside, for example.
Oh, yeah. The best word of advice is to plant salt-tolerant plants in areas that you know are subject to salt spray. Most residential roads, you don't have a huge issue with salt spray because hopefully everybody is going slow on the road. But if you live near a road that has faster-moving traffic, interstate, well, actually your house wouldn't be on an interstate, but yeah, the main roads in your county, they often have a lot of salt applied, so keep salt-sensitive species away. And then also where you can always do protective barriers such as burlap. Don't wrap the burlap tight around the plant. It should act more like a barrier. So sticking some stakes in the ground and putting burlap around the perimeter of the plant, but not tight against the plant. I do not recommend using any antitranspirants or even dormant oil for preventing salt injury. They're ineffective. They wash off easily in terms of antitranspirants, and they just don't work for this. Other things you can do is direct the salt runoff from snow. That can accumulate salt in the soil. Direct it away. Flush your soil. I discuss other techniques in more detail in the publication, and it's free to download at the Learning Store. It's one word, learningstore.uwex.edu, and the publication is A3877, and you can just Google salt injury, and this publication should come up.
Laura Jell, our guest today, a professor and extension specialist for woody ornamentals in the UW-Madison Department of Horticulture. Questions for her, give a call at 1-800-642-1234 and email us with your questions at ideas@wpr.org or post on Twitter at the Larry Mueller Show Twitter page. I think you mentioned winterburn once.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I also have a publication fact sheet on winter burn. Again, if this one is not at the Learning Store. This is available on a different website, and it's available at the Wisconsin Urban Horticulture Update. And if you type in hort.uwex.edu, and then in the search box type in winter burn, it's two words, and you'll see a publication I did on winterburn. It's got a real nice picture of a dwarf Alberta spruce that half the plant's brown and half of it's green. And you can see the effects of winterburn. Now, winterburn is not salt injury. It's very different. And it's often a problem on broadleaf evergreens like rhododendrons, boxwood sometimes, also on spruce, yews especially. Occasionally, you'll see it on arborvitae. I've even seen it on very severe winters on junipers, which is rare. These plants are mainly grown in open, unprotected locations, and they're exposed to the winter sun and winter winds coming from the west. And evergreens are the ones that are effective. Deciduous plants, they don't have leaves in the winter, so they're not going to suffer from winter burn.
So it's a question of wind and sun, maybe even more than temperature.
Yes. A lot of what happens is these evergreen plants are going into fall, or going into winter, and they could be drought stressed, for example. And the plants are not well hydrated going into winter, or they're newly planted. And when the ground freezes, the plant has a very hard time taking water up into the root system to replace that's being lost from these evergreen needles. And with the winds and the sun, and we've had these up and down temperatures this year in winter, I think we're going to see some significant winter burn on some plants.
And how does it look when you do see it again?
Well, very often a classic symptom of winter burn, similar to salt injury, is that one side of the plant is often affected, and that's the side that's facing the northwestern winds or that are coming out from our climate down from Canada, and that side of the plant will often have needles that turn brown, whereas the other side of the plant that's more in shade or out of the winter winds will be totally green. And all you have to do is just walk around the plant and you can see the damage. Not all evergreens suffer winter burn. Some of them do better than others, and if you look at the fact sheet, I talk about that.
And if you look at it, does it look much different from salt damage or not?
Well, that's where you have to be a good investigator. And if you think about winter burn, that can happen in your backyard and no salt has been applied, so that you can rule out salt damage right away. If it's something that is near a road and you see this type of injury, it could be salt injury, could be winter burn. Plants that are really sensitive or prone to winter burn are the ones that you need to put in a protected location out of winter sun, out of winter winds, like, for example, dwarf Alberta spruce and some of the yews. Yews especially really shouldn't be out in the hot baking sun. They're more shade plants.
Yeah. If you think about pruning them, I mean, you've got a kind of a problem there with a lot of those woody ornamentals. If you're going to,
yeah,
those needles, you know, if it's dead.
Yeah, they're not going to go from brown back to green again. They're dead. And pruning out all that brown material and dead twigs, you'll have a huge hole in your plant, and it won't look very good. However, especially with yews and boxwood, they're pretty tough. I mean, if it's just one side of a plant, then you can chop, or not chop, but prune the plant back to live wood. And especially with yews and boxwood, they regenerate and will fill back in, but it takes a long time. It's not a quick. But if your entire plant is brown, then I would replace it.
What about pruning in general? Let's talk a little bit about that. We don't have a lot of time left, for example, to prune oaks and elms, I don't
think. Right. Yes, I'm glad you mentioned that, Larry. Oaks and elms, you know, they say April 15th. I'm moving it up to April 1st. It really depends on how warm our March is. And the reason why we don't want to prune our oaks or elms past that date, with oaks we have a very serious disease called oak wilt. And oak wilt is transferred by the picnic beetle. And the picnic beetle becomes active in April, and it can transfer the fungus from a sick tree to a healthy tree. And so that's something we recommend. I work with the Wisconsin Arborist Association, very good association to be a member of, and they also recommend that as well. And with elms, we have something called Dutch elm disease. And Dutch elm disease, similar to oak wilt, is a vascular wilt, meaning it plugs up the xylem, and water can't be conducted from the bottom of the tree to the top of the tree. And the insects, the elm bark beetle that transfers the Dutch elm disease fungi, actually is attracted to fresh cut wounds and becomes active in the spring. So that's why we recommend pruning, especially oaks and elms, prior to April 1st, if not earlier, depending how warm March is.
I tried to prune a large tree once myself with my own my own saw and my own equipment, and I got going on it, and I decided that probably better for somebody who knew what the heck they were doing.
Yeah.
I mean, I knew what I should do, but I didn't really have the kind of equipment.
Yeah. I do have 3 fact sheets on pruning. One is pruning trees, one is pruning shrubs, and the other is pruning evergreens. And again, if you go to the Wisconsin Horticulture Extension website, again, hort.uwex.edu, and if you go to that site and you type in pruning, you'll see my 3 publications, and it talks about how to prune various species. Now, when it comes to larger trees or trees, anything that you have to take a ladder out, I recommend a professional arborist, one that is certified by the International Society of Arboriculture. It's also abbreviated ISA. And an ISA certified arborist has taken an exam, knows what they're doing, makes sure they're licensed, and has this accreditation, because there's a lot of people out there that aren't certified, that really shouldn't be pruning trees. I'm not saying everybody who isn't certified isn't qualified, but there are so many that aren't qualified and really butcher trees that, to play it safe, I would hire a certified arborist.
Laura Jell, our guest today, professor and extension specialist for woody ornamentals in the Department of Horticulture at UW-Madison. We'll take some calls now. You can join in, 800-642-1234, the number to call. I'm Larry Mueller, Jill Nadeau, our producer for Garden Talk, here on the Ideas Network. Lots of callers online. We will take your calls at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. That works as well. Katie in De Pere has something for us, Laura, so let's go there. Hi, Katie.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I had two questions, if there's time for that. The first is, I have a large weeping willow tree in our backyard, and it seems to get covered in tiny little black beetles. I'm not sure if it's like a type of aphid or something like that. I'm wondering what the best way to, if you have any ideas on how to treat something like that would be, if you would know. My other question is on just general tips on pruning on like an overgrown lilac bush.
Okay. The first question regarding the willow, are they kind of like a metallic blue insect?
They're small. They're almost like a pinhead, and they're dark. They could be, I guess, a dark blue. They almost look black.
Yeah. And the reason why I ask is the first thing I thought of is willow leaf beetle, which eats the leaves of willow. Willows have a lot of pest and disease problems. Very fast-growing and, I guess, very tasty to insects. I'm not sure without seeing a picture what your actual insect is. There are other insects that feed on willow leaves. Best thing to do, I know it's not the time of year to take pictures of leaves, but in the spring or summer when you start seeing those insects, take a picture. And I would contact PJ Leisch at the Insect Diagnostic Clinic here at UW-Madison. He's the extension specialist for and runs the insect diagnostic lab, and he should be able to pinpoint exactly which critter it is.
Yeah.
Insect diagnostic lab. Okay, great. Thank you.
All right.
Sure. And regarding the pruning of lilacs, don't do it now. And the reason why is lilacs have already set their flower buds for this coming spring back in summer. Yes, actually, the buds for next year are set in the summer or soon after they're done flowering. They start to form new buds for next year. So if you prune them now, you'll be removing some flower buds. However, I like to prune this time of year myself because I can get in and see what I'm doing. There's no mosquitoes flying around, and you can really see the architecture of the shrubs. And something like a large common lilac or French lilac, renewal pruning is what is needed. And again, that fact sheet I told you about pruning shrubs discusses that and how to do it. Just realize you will be sacrificing some flowers this spring. And renewal pruning is removing some of the larger diameter branches back to the base of the plant because the suckering new wood, once it gets about 2 to 3 years old, becomes very productive for flowers. And when they branches get really large in diameter at the base, they tend to not only attract lilac borers, but also flower production can go down. And then just the fact that the flowers are out of your nose and eye view, you can't smell them because they're 20 feet in the air.
Yeah.
Okay.
And usually you say, what do you say, about a third?
Yeah, about a third. It really depends on the plant. I mean, if you only have one large stem, it kind of depletes the purpose.
It's about 8 feet tall.
Yeah,
it's about 8 feet tall.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it has a lot of branches coming from the base.
It does. Yep, and it mostly flowers at the top of the tree.
Yep.
This renewal pruning, and look my pruning publication up on the Wisconsin Horticulture Extension website. And
Sounds like a perfect candidate, though, for knocking out those biggest branches.
Largest diameter branches, And it will take a year or two to start really seeing more flowers. But when you do this type of pruning on a yearly or bi-yearly basis for certain species, not every species likes this type of pruning, I did it to my neighbor's forsythia, and 2 years later, it just bloomed its heart out. It was gorgeous. And unfortunately, I got new neighbors and won't let me touch it.
Well, maybe after a few years, they'll come around, Laura.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Katie.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Oh, man. Ken in Mayville, it's your turn. Hi, Ken.
How you doing? I'm going to try to create a visual here. I have a couple of espalier pear trees, and for some reason I forgot to configure one of the branches in the fall. They've firmed up to where they're not, you know, not real supple. But what I want to do is bend the branch at this point. And I'm just wondering if I was able to make small, like, V-shaped cuts into the side that would be on the inside of the curve and then make the bend, would that heal up, like, as if it was being grafted? Or should I just try to very, very, very slowly make the bend over a few month period, like either weighting it down or something to where the...
Yeah, I would not make those...
grows.
Yeah, I would not make those V-shaped cuts. So you're saying that the branch is growing towards you and not flat against the wall?
Well, they're in an open plane. They're not necessarily on a wall. But basically, I forgot to bend my final leader. I didn't bend my final leader down. Mm-hmm. So that final leader would be the top of the tree, and I wanted to bend it down rather than just cutting it off and topping off the tree at that point.
Great. Well, for our audience, espalier is a form of pruning where you take, it's commonly done in fruit trees, and you prune them so that they're almost flattened plane, not three-dimensional. And this was done by Thomas Jefferson, and it's been done for centuries. And it's a way of growing fruit crops, especially, you know, your fruit trees in small areas so they don't take up a lot of space. It's high maintenance. It's something you have to constantly prune branches so they're not coming outwards, but you also don't want to cut off the flower buds, obviously, because that's what produces the fruit. Now, in your situation, I would do it probably slowly. I really can't visualize what you're saying. A picture would really help. And if you could email me a picture.
Okay.
Or if you're in the area, I could look at it. I'm not quite sure where you're located.
Yeah. Well, I think that basically answers my question. I know if I do it slowly, I could, it may take all summer of just waiting, pulling that branch down to where it's
right.
In place. I was more concerned with, you know, making the cuts. Would that actually, you know, would that damage the tree, or would they be able to grow as far as a... as a graft, but I knew that was kind of a far stretch.
Yeah.
I mean, if the branch isn't needed to begin with, and you've got others, because with espalier, you're not interested in height, you're interested in width.
Yeah, no, it's my final, it was where I was basically going to top it there anyway, but I'm like, well, why didn't I just bend that leader down and rather than having an open cut?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it can be bent down, but see, it's hard wood right now. It's not going to bend.
Yeah.
So you might want to cut it back somewhat and leave some buds behind, and then those shoots you could train to grow horizontally.
Oh, be another way to do it for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call, Ken. We have... and by the way, Jill let me know that she's added the link to your salt damage publication to our Ideas Network Facebook page show post. So, folks, if you didn't get all the information, you can just go there and get a quick link to it.
Did she put the Winterburn one on, too?
Yep. She did put the Winterburn, or she will. She says she just put her thumb up. So it's thumbs
great.
Up. She'll do that right away.
Excellent.
Let's take some more calls. By the way, there's an open line. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Talking woody ornamentals today with Laura Jell from UW-Madison Extension and the Department of Horticulture. Star in Viroqua up next. Hi, Star. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, I have a gigantic white pine, and it's right near my house. And for about, like, 3 years, I have a pileated woodpecker who is visiting it and just, you know, just, like, 8 feet up of holes in the mid part of the tree. Can I trim that up and wrap it, or how do I get rid of that bird without hurt? Oh,
I like pileated woodpeckers. I find them fascinating.
Oh, they are.
They are, and they're at your, and by the way, a big white pine, kudos to you. That's a beautiful species. It's one of my favorites. Being close, is it right next to your house, like really close?
Like about 6 feet away.
Ooh. Yeah, that's close.
Yeah.
They can get up to, you know, 50, 70 feet wide. They can get quite bad. I've got one in my yard, and it takes up a good half of my berm. But in terms of the woodpecker, yeah, that's a hard one. I would recommend you contact the, I'm trying to remember his name. It's not Scott Craven anymore. It's
David Drake.
David Drake, thank you. He's at the in the Department of
Forest and Wildlife Ecology.
Forest and Wildlife Ecology here at UW-Madison, and he's an extension specialist. He may give you some hints on how to avoid the woodpecker injury, but that woodpecker likes your tree, and the damage, the holes, the plant will naturally compartmentalize the wounds and close the wounds. But if the woodpecker comes back, it's going to do more holes. But I don't know. I kind of like the woodpecker myself.
It's it's probably looking for insects that are in the tree.
Yeah.
In the winter? Yeah.
Or sap or whatever.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. We'll do that. Thank you for your advice.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Sometimes people put little mirrors up and little jangly things.
Like compact discs.
And hang them up in the tree just to scare the bird away. And sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah, or have a black lab at the base of the tree.
Barking away.
Yeah.
There you go. Oh, man. Darwin in Frederick, your turn now. Hi, Darwin.
Hey, Larry. This is Darwin. And I really like your show. I always listen to it.
Thank you.
I got a question, and time allows, I got a comment, too, but... about 40 years ago, I planted these Norway pine and Norwegian spruce next to the road as a visual barrier. And last year, I started my solar array on the opening that was just to the north of those trees. Now, these trees are probably 40 feet high, and during the shortest solar window in December and January, they're starting to shade my solar array. But I did a kind of triangulation on them, and I think I can cut off the top 15 feet of those trees.
I do not
recommend. Well, I kill those trees by doing that.
Yes.
You will? I will. My engineer said just cut them down.
If it's not a species you want anymore, I would cut down. Anytime you remove that much of a tree, that is a lot. You will set that tree into a decline. And especially with evergreens, whether it's a spruce or a pine, they grow from the tips. Pines with spruce and firs, they do have some lateral buds, but the new growth comes at the ends of the branches. And by taking out 15 feet, what's called topping, and I never recommend topping trees. It causes lots of open wounds that disease fungi can move in. It also depletes the energy source significantly from the tree. Anytime you top, it's often the death sentence for trees.
Well, it's kind of a double-edged sword. They provide a lot of wind protection,
right?
And my solar array is going to be a little bit susceptible to that. But I'm losing my sun during 3 months of the year on part of it. So, and I'll have to really think about it before I start cutting on them. I have a comment. I was cutting my oak tree the other day that had been blowing over. It's probably 30 inches in diameter, blocking it up in the firewood. About 8 feet up from the roots, there's a hole in the side of the tree.
Mm-hmm.
And like a limb had rotted or, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So I blocked this tree up probably 6 feet from it was from the ground before it tipped over. And I started cutting through it, and sparks started flying off my chainsaw. And I thought, what is going on here? And so I replaced the chain because it dulled it instantly. And I cut again from a different angle, and sparks flew again. Well, I ended up splitting the log in half, and there was a rotted portion on the inside of that log, and there was one-inch rocks inside that log. What would cause, where would that come from? There was like two or three, and I just happened luckily hit them, or unluckily hit them with my chainsaw.
What well, they could have, rocks? If there was a cavity there, the previous person that lived there might have said, oh, I'm just, for structure, I'm going to fill the hole with rocks. And that's not something you want to ever do. That's not effective.
Well, this has been on my farm as long from my grandfather. I got the farm, so.
Uh-huh. I would.
And, you know, it seemed like it was pretty solid down towards the ground from that spot.
Mm-hmm.
Really interesting. Maybe there was a rambunctious squirrel that had an opening and dropped him down in there.
Well, that's a good suggestion. A friend of mine suggested a crow.
Crows don't actually pick up rocks.
You know, yeah.
They pick up goofy things like that.
Was there a lot of rocks?
There was probably, a half a dozen. The one-inch diameter was the largest.
Yeah, I don't know. Somebody did that. I don't think it's an animal.
I wouldn't put it past a squirrel.
Really?
It was approximately 8 feet from the ground where the hole was.
Yeah, it could be making a nest, but I usually don't see them picking up rocks for making nests.
I thought it was kind of bizarre.
Maybe somebody else will have another idea other than the ones we've already raised, Darwin. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you, Larry.
I appreciate the call. Very interesting little mystery there.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Holly in Wausau, on to you now. Hi, Holly.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, appreciate the call. What can we do for you today?
Well, I have got a question about a serviceberry, 12 to 15 foot tall, planted on each corner of a property, of a house, you know. And they're just getting too tall. I know you can trim them, but I'm just really nervous about taking them down to the ground, you know.
Oh, yeah, do that.
You know, I was considering, I mean, I've had luck taking them down to about chest height, you know, and letting them flourish back. But, I mean, it takes a year or two. My thought is, should I take some of them down to the ground, similar to a lilac, and some of them to head height? Or, you know, that's the ultimate goal is you know, probably head height for the
Amelinker probably wasn't the best choice.
Because,
depending on the species and the most common ones we see is the Amelinker grandiflora, and that is the apple serviceberry. It's a hybrid of our two native species, and it produces obviously phenomenal flowers. Unfortunately, they're short-lived, but the fruit is absolutely delicious, and the fall color is nice as well. And they grow slowly, and I would never take an Amelinker and cut the whole thing back to the ground. They can sucker, but very slowly, and chances are you're going to kill your plant by taking the whole thing back to the ground. Doing some reduction cuts where you're taking from the tip of the tree back down to a lateral branch, you can do that. But I wouldn't do drastic pruning on an Amelinker.
Okay. I'm not sure the variety.
Pardon?
I said I'm not sure the variety. It's a multi-stemmed serviceberry, both of them. But it's that variety. I know it's not that one. It's on the tip of my tongue, but I can't think of it offhand.
Okay.
Yeah, and I'd say the largest stem coming off is probably 3 inches of the multi-stem size. So.
Yeah. That's going to be challenging. And if it's too tall, please call a certified arborist to do it. A lot of people every year are killed hanging out on their ladders trying to prune their trees. It's not worth it.
Yeah.
Sure. Absolutely.
Someone to come out and do it for you, I think would be the best solution.
All right.
Okay. All right. Thank you for your help.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Holly, for calling. And on to Harriet in Racine. Hi, Harriet.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a mulberry and a sycamore that are having a dark liquid that's coming out of the trunk. I suspect that I had looked it up, and I think it might be some type of fungus. And it has the nickname starts with S, but I can't remember the name of it.
Slime flux.
Pardon?
Slime flux.
Yes.
Or wet leaf.
I read that trees can survive that fungus, but I suspect that the reason that the trees got the fungus is because I didn't water them during the drought spells that we had, you know, like in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking what I'm really concerned about, the mulberry I know I could replace. You know, it was a dwarf that grew really fast and produced a lot of fruit. But the sycamore is like 2.5 feet in diameter, and it's a big, beautiful tree that shades the house. And I'm just sick about it because everywhere I look, there's a branch, or used to be a branch, this black liquid is coming out, and the bark is puffing up and peeling off.
Yeah, doesn't sound good.
Yeah, the sycamores do naturally have exfoliating bark. They do naturally peel. When it comes to the mulberry, I would get rid of it. It's invasive. It's actually no longer available in the state of Wisconsin for sale or distribution. It's on the DNR NR 40 invasive species list. And, yes, I know the fruit's tasty. I like them too, but it's really quite an invasive species. The birds eat the fruit, and they fly away, and they deposit the seed, and up comes a new plant. When it comes to sycamore, I would, it could be due to a number of factors, and it's usually not that dark colored. I mean, it can be dark, but black, it sounds kind of weird, but I would have a certified arborist come out and look at your tree. And by the way, you can find a list of certified arborists on the Wisconsin Arborist Association website, and it's under Certified Arborists for Hire category on their webpage. And you can search by your county, and you can. I can't recommend anybody on the air for obvious reasons, but there are a lot of very qualified, certified ISA certified arborists in the state that could come out and look at your tree. Something like this, I think, needs a professional to look at it.
Yeah.
Okay, because I had read that it can't be cured. There isn't anything that you can do for it. But what you can do is give the tree what it needs, whether it's fertilizer or water or whatever, and then it can survive it.
Yeah. Okay. I first of all would not fertilize, first of all, because it sounds like your tree's already big. And trees produce their own food. Fertilizer is used in growth, but it's not if the soil is sufficient enough and the plant is not sick or chlorotic looking, don't fertilize. It's not needed. When it comes to nutrient deficiencies, then yes, the fertilization would be needed. Watering sycamores obviously are notorious for their high water demand, but they can also tolerate, you know, a little bit drier, not severe droughts, but sycamores are pretty tough. And they often are found growing along riverbanks or floodplains. The one disease that sycamore does get quite often is called anthracnose. But anthracnose doesn't cause the oozing like you're describing. This almost sounds like wetwood. But, again, that's where a certified arborist can come and diagnose your problem.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks so much, Harriet, for calling. Laura Jull, our guest today, professor and extension specialist for woody ornamentals in the Department of Horticulture at UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Great to have you along for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with woody ornamental specialist Laura Jull. Lots of callers online. There's one open line, though, at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Let's go back to the phones and to Richard in Colfax next. Hi, Richard.
Hi. I purchased a cotton Easter shrub about 12 years ago. The year I bought it, it flowered and had a couple fruit, and it has never flowered since. It's very healthy. It's probably 9 feet tall now, but it hasn't had one single flower since then. I'm wondering if maybe pruning wouldn't cause it to flower. What do you think?
Okay, cotone asters, usually you see them as dwarf foot to 3 foot tall plants, but there are other cotone asters that get quite large. And obviously, if you're saying it's 9 feet tall, it's the big one. It sounds like it could be the many flowered cotone aster multiflorus. And I'm not sure why it's not flowering. Do you have it in full sun?
Yes.
Okay. Are you pruning it?
No.
Okay. If you were pruning it, you could be cutting off flower buds. Do you have a lot of branch dieback?
None. I'm looking at it out the window right now, and, you know, it's very healthy looking. It's going to bud out all over, I think.
Yeah, there is another cotone aster species, cotone aster divaricatus, spreading cotone aster. That one can get tall, but usually not 9 feet. I've usually seen it top at about 6 to 8. And that one is marginally hardy. Where are you located?
Well, the map's a zone 4. I'm just north of I-94, about 10 miles, 100 miles east of Minneapolis. Directly east.
Okay. It could be that the flower buds are being killed over winter.
Well, yeah. That's a possibility.
Yeah.
I never thought of that.
Yeah, some of the cotone esters are zone 5, and you might be in the zone 4.
Yeah, I am in zone 4. I used to be in zone 3 until we had, I hate to say this, global warming.
Climate change, yeah.
Yeah, it's climate change. It definitely has made a difference here. My coldest temperature this winter was 21 below, and the three previous winters, it never got below that either. Of course, we had the really severe one about 4 years ago, and I did lose plants, but not that cotton Easter. I lost Honeycrisp and some... Washington
Hawthorn?
Yes, Washington Hawthorn. I didn't lose them. They rebudded in the summer. They pushed new buds through that dead bark.
Good.
And are doing well now.
Well, good.
Unfortunately, my Honeycrisp aren't doing well because the bear tore them down last summer to get at the apples.
Oh, no.
Well, I think you probably, the winter kill of those buds sounds like you came up with a good.
Yeah, that's what I think's going on. It still leaves out, correct?
And I can do about that.
Yeah, no, there's nothing you can do. It still leaves out, too.
Yeah, it sounds like the flower buds are being killed.
So you need to hope for even more climate change, I guess, Richard. No, you may just have to give up on it and try something else if you really want want those buds to flower.
You might want to try, well, it's black fruit, but it's really beautiful, our native black chokeberry, Aronia melanocarpa. There's some dwarf cultivars out there as well as some bigger ones. And that is reliably hardy in your area. And the fruit's beautiful.
All right, there you go.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Let's go to Don in Eau Claire next. Don, hi, thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. We have three Flaming Voice plants right next to a short sidewalk that goes from the driveway to the front porch. There's on the house on the other side of the walk. There are three kitchen windows. Last spring, before the flowering season, we trimmed them back. They're doing beautifully. I'm expecting a wonderful display this fall. My concern is, one, I'm physically handicapped and in a wheelchair, and whereas I don't get out that much, we do have to keep the sidewalk open. I want to know how much I can trim them back and when.
What is the species?
Beg pardon?
What is the plant?
It's a flaming bush.
You mean burning bush?
Burning bush, yes.
Yes, yes, okay. Burning bush, a lot of people butcher them. By the way, the burning bush is invasive. It is on the DNR NR40 list of invasive species. The cultivar Nordine is no longer able to be sold in the state, though through research that has been conducted in Kentucky or Connecticut has shown that all the cultivars can become invasive because of the fruit, and the birds eat the fruit and fly away and deposit the seed. The best way to prune burning bush, some people shear them. I personally don't like the look of a sheared burning bush, but you can bring with your pruners, hand pruners, you can, if you're able to, take the branches and go back from the tip of the branch back to a lateral branch and prune right above a lateral branch that's farther back inside the plant, and that will bring it back in line to off of the sidewalk area that you're talking about.
All right, that makes good sense. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, you can do it now.
And yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Don. We have Bob in Amherst Junction up next. Bob, hello.
Hi there, Larry. That was a really bad joke about global warming.
I know. It was terrible.
Okay. Well, I have a question and a comment. My question is that I had this idea that I would save berries from all of these ornamental service berries that I see around.
Mm-hmm.
Like in Amherst, in Madison, there's, you know, they planted service berries along the roads, and they just shed all these berries.
That,
and if I took those
right.
berries and I took them out and put them on my back 20, would they grow into anything that would be good for wildlife?
Service berries, and when you said that it sheds all its fruit, that's very surprising because I have a service berry in my yard, and the birds gobble the fruit up. It's one of Robin's favorite snacks in spring. I try to get out there and collect them myself because they're absolutely delicious. I think they rival blueberries for their flavor. In terms of collecting seed, is that what you're
asking?
Yeah, well, yeah, there are places in Madison where they planted them along the roadside, and apparently the birds just don't get to all of it. So a lot of it ends up just, you know, on the sidewalk getting crushed.
Yeah, that, and you're sure it's service berry?
Yeah.
And not crab apples or?
No. Oh, no, I can identify the leaf.
Okay. Yeah, service berry produces its fruit in June. It's also known as June berry. And it's not the most desirable species for planting near a street because of salt. They can tolerate a little bit, but they're also a species that really prefers some afternoon shade. The morning sun is fine, but the hot baking sun they don't particularly like. They suffer from drought stress, is what I'm saying. In terms of collecting the seed and trying to start new plants, with woody ornamentals, many of the newer cultivars, as well as most of the older cultivars, if you grow them from seed, they're not going to be the same cultivar as the one that you have in your yard or on the street. And that's because, without trying to sound too scientific, they're very heterozygous, meaning they have lots of genes, and if you try to reproduce them by seed, they may not produce the same plant. In fact, it very often doesn't. It'll produce the same species, but if it's a specific cultivar, it probably won't, and you'll get all different types of shrubs. And some may have, like, green leaves in the fall with lousy fall color, and some may have beautiful fall color. Some may be short, some may be tall. And emulators are really, really difficult to root from cuttings. most of the amelanchers that are started, a lot of them are started in micropropagation tissue culture. And so you can try it with the seeds, but I don't guarantee they're going to look the same.
So how do I mimic what I see sometimes in northern Wisconsin where there are some really healthy patches of serviceberry?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of different species of serviceberry. There's some that are more shrub-like and some that are more single-stem tree-like. Up north in northern Wisconsin, it's the shrub type you often see that sucker quite readily. And, you know, if it's one of those species, you can plant it and it'll continue to sucker and, it'll, you know, several plants will fill in an area.
Good. All right, thank you very much.
All right, thanks. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Lots of good questions going on this morning,
yeah.
Laura.
Yeah, I'm glad I had my tea this morning. My caffeine kick.
Oh, man. Laura Jull is our guest today here on Garden Talk. Laura is a professor. She is an extension specialist for woody ornamentals in the Department of Horticulture at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Talking with her today, boy, we got into winter. We're getting into winter salt, and we're getting into all kinds of things with her. And it's always fun to talk with Laura here for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller. My guest, Laura Jull, professor and extension specialist for woody ornamentals in the Department of Horticulture at UW-Madison, talking about all kinds of things relating to woody ornamentals, winter damage, pruning, all kinds of things. Give a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on Twitter for us as well. We have callers waiting, so let's go back to the phones, Laura, and Kim in Dodgeville up next. Kim, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just have a question. Was it aronia berry? Was that what was brought up before the break?
Yes.
Is that, do we grow that in direct sun?
Oh, yeah. In,
or acidic soil?
The nice thing about aronia, the black chokeberry in particular, that one can tolerate sun to part shade, not full shade. They won't flower very well. The flowers are white. They're pretty. But the fruit is what's really gorgeous. The fruit is black, and it's very shiny. And it stays on for a very long time because it's the birds don't particularly like them until later on in the season. And the fall color is a fantastic orange to bright red. It's there are dwarf cultivars that can be used as foundation plants, like the brand new one, the Lowscape Mound. Lowscape Mound is a nice one. There's also Iroquois Beauty, which gets a little bit taller, about 3 feet, 3 to 4 feet. And they can tolerate high pH or low pH. They're a fantastic plant, and they can tolerate wet or dry soils.
Very good. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for calling. And on to Greg in Milwaukee. Thanks for calling, Greg.
Hello. Hey, I have a question. Now, I knew Hannondale's orchard, the one that was by the 41 Twin in Franklin, and he used to graft trees. He never showed me how, and I knew Another gentleman, I forgot his name, Schmigelski or something like that, that used to graft trees. He was out on Highway 45. He had an orchard. But I cut down a Macintosh tree, and I threw it all in a 35-gallon drum, and it was all sealed all summer, and I was going to smoke some catfish, and I opened it up, and all these little chunks had roots coming out of them. And I was wondering if I'd have planted those little chunks, if I would have got Macintosh trees.
Maybe. It all depends on if it was a rootstock and they grafted Macintosh cultivar on top. A lot of times it's not the same if it's coming from the roots or the trunk.
All the branches I cut up.
Okay. The branches, that's really strange because apples are very difficult to root.
Yeah.
I threw a 35-gallon, it was an iodine drum from H&P Industries Triad Medical when they were out in Franklin. And I threw all these things in there. I washed the drum out and cleaned it, and then I threw all these chunks in there to use them for smoker wood, smoke catfish, and when I opened it up, they were all rooting.
Maybe you've stumbled on a new system, Greg.
Well, these have grown. I've always been curious my whole life. This happened years ago, but.
Ah, man.
Yeah, that's very odd because, yeah, apples are difficult to root from cuttings, and they're typically grafted where they have a different cultivar or a different species like East Meling or some of the dwarfing rootstocks, and then the cultivar, like Honeycrisp, for example, is grafted onto it and then grown. So yeah. What you're seeing, I'm not familiar with that happening with apples.
Yeah, that's a strange one. It's going to remain a mystery, Greg, but thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Oh, man. Ken from De Pere emailed to say he has a sugar maple with a large limb removed, 18 inches diameter or more, and the collar of the wound was cut so that the water collects in it.
Oh, that's
right. Yeah, it was somebody who didn't know what they were doing there. It seems to prevent the wound from healing and promoting rotting. It was suggested that he repair the wound with spray foam, like great stuff, to cover it and prevent water from collecting in the wound. Is that a good idea?
Yeah, no. When it comes to doing any, and that is a very large limb, 18 inches in diameter.
Yeah.
Wow. I don't recommend pruning that large of a limb corresponding to the rest of the tree. You never want to remove more than 25% of a tree's canopy at one pruning.
Maybe this one was damaged or something.
Yeah, it could have been, yeah. And then pruning properly, staying away from the branch collar, because when you're cutting into the branch collar, you're actually cutting into trunk wood and not necessarily branch wood. And when you cut into the trunk wood, into the collar, that area is very slow to compartmentalize and close the wound and form callus. And then disease organisms can very quickly move into the trunk of the sugar maple tree. And unfortunately, just for our audience, when you have to prune large limbs that big, chances are you may be able to reduce the height of a tree a different way. I would, again, call a certified arborist to come out and look at your plant. I don't make any money on promoting these guys, so I just want it to be safe for people as well as the tree.
You know, Katie, Barbara, and some other moms called the show to tell Jill that the rocks in the tree, remember that tree, were probably put there by kids.
Okay.
And, you know, that makes sense, doesn't it?
That makes a lot of sense.
Okay. Oh, boy. On to some more callers. Let's go to Steve in Fitchburg next. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thanks for the call. I've got a red bark bush down by near the street, a curbless subdivision, and I've got a smoke tree that's about 4 or 5 years old, about 15 feet tall. The smoke bush is.
Yep.
And I'd like to keep it about that size, but I've been pruning it back, and then I get really spindly legs going up and a lot of leaves at the end. It's not very attractive. How do you deal with that?
Is it a true smoke tree or a smoke bush? What color are the leaves?
Smoke bush. The leaves are still on it.
I mean, during the growing season, are the leaves green or red?
They're green.
They're green. Okay. Well, smoke bushes can get very big. The actual smoke bush can get, 15 feet tall, easy. Smoke tree is a different species, related to smoke bush, and smoke tree can get up to 30 feet tall and tends to have a single trunk. You're saying this is multi-trunked?
Yes.
Multi-stemmed, I mean? I would look at the fact sheet I have online on pruning shrubs, And what you could do is, if it's getting too tall, maybe some of the taller branches you can cut back to a lateral branch, making sure it's larger than what you're removing, to control the height. Don't top it indiscriminately. Always bring it back to a node or where a bud or a branch is located. But, yeah, they're going to have a fighting battle with that. They get big.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, and I have seen some people cut theirs, you know, doing renewal pruning where they remove a third of the largest diameter branches every few years. You don't have to do it every year. And suckers will come back up from the root system, and you can maintain the height a little bit better that way.
Mm. Steve, thank you for calling. On to Paul in Schofield. Hi, Paul.
You're talking to me?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, I'm in Holman.
Holman, sorry.
It's a great show. I'm enjoying it. And by the way, thank you for the tip on the burning bush. I've got a couple in my yard. I have a saucer magnolia tree that I've had for many years, but I planted it from a stick, and it's got three mains that are coming basically out of grade level. And I need to cut them back because it's getting about 12 feet tall. I need to know, can I cut that much at one time? That's basically two-thirds of the plant.
No.
Yeah, that's what I'm getting at. But what time of year should I prune one of the mains out of there?
Well, let me ask this question. Why do you need to prune it back?
Well, is it supposed to be extremely slow-growing?
It is, but they can get up to 30 feet in height.
I know, but it's been growing successfully, I might add, very wonderful blooms for 12, 13 years, and it's only about 12 feet tall.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't know if that's just because it's trying to treat all three of them as a full tree.
Well, it's, you know, saucers are, I'm not sure where Holman, Wisconsin is.
North of La Crosse.
Oh, boy. And you still have flowers every year?
Oh, it's beautiful. It's full. I'll get hundreds.
Got a little microclimate going there,
yeah.
Paul.
Yeah.
Well, no, I did it proper, and I kind of protected
okay.
Northwest.
Okay, great. Yeah, because that's a Zone 5 plant. It's a beautiful plant. I would not remove that much at one period of time. And you said you have three stems coming from the base?
He was talking about taking out one whole stem.
No.
Yeah, they're about 3 inches plus each one.
Yeah, I would do some selective bringing the height down by pruning back to a lateral branch, but not removing the whole branch. Because if you did that, you're removing a third of the plant. And
that'll
that's too much.
Yeah, so, well, I mean, if there's no problem with it, I can just leave it. I don't care.
I would leave it.
It's something I planted for the wife, so.
As yeah, I'd leave
not
it.
Not crossing or rubbing branches.
I've trimmed those out, so it's not crossing over. So it's still clean inside, and there's
Leave it alone.
Pores inside it.
Yeah, this sounds beautiful.
Yeah, leave it alone. There you go, Paul. Thanks a lot for calling. No work required there, or very little.
Yeah.
On to Chuck in La Crosse. Hi, Chuck.
Hi. Say, first I have a comment and then a question.
Sure.
The comment is, aronias are fantastic plants, and I love them. I planted them at my house and also out at at a small farm I have. But the deer will strip the leaves off of those things faster than anything I have on the farm. Even when they have plenty of food, they seem to really prefer that. And they can take a plant down to the bare stems within a matter of one night. So I would urge people to be cautious as far as using it in their landscaping if they've got a deer issue at all. The question I have is that at my farm, there's quite a few rows of walnuts that were planted about 20 years ago, and a lot of the ash that were co-planted with them have died out, which is probably good because the walnuts now have more room to grow and such, but I would still like to put some bushes and such underneath them. About the only thing that I have planted now is dogwood, and I'd like to sort of broaden the the different types of plants I have. What would you suggest for woody bushes underneath walnuts?
Well, that's a very good question. Are you familiar with black walnut toxicity?
Yes, of course. Juglone.
Yep, juglone. And for the viewer or the listeners in on the show, black walnut toxicity happens in black walnut trees as well as butternut. The roots, the fruit, the twigs, they all produce a chemical called juglone. And juglone is allelopathic, meaning it kills other plants that grow near it. It doesn't hurt the black walnut, but it's kind of like the bully of the black walnut. It doesn't like let other people play with them, meaning it doesn't allow certain species to grow near a black walnut. I do have a fact sheet, again, on the horticulture, uwex.edu, the hort.uwex.edu, that talks about black walnut toxicity and some plants that are very sensitive to it and plants that are a little bit more tolerant to it. You can always go out in the woods and see a black walnut and see what's naturally growing near it. There are a number of species that are very sensitive to black walnut toxicity. A lot of evergreens are, for example, and anything in the solanaceous family, like tomatoes, peppers, and so on, are really sensitive to it. And off the top of my head, I would have to look at the sheet to give you some suggestions, but there's a number of species that are quite sensitive to it.
Yeah. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Dan in South Milwaukee, it's on to you now. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I had a red maple that has white rings developing on it. They're about a foot in diameter, and the ring is about 3 inches wide. And then inside the ring, the bark is a darker color than the rest of the tree. I was wondering, kind of looks like a mildew. I'm not sure, though.
You're talking the trunk of the tree, correct?
Correct.
Yeah, okay. Could be lichens. Lichens are a symbiotic relationship between an algae and, if I remember correctly, a bacteria. I always get those two mixed up. But it's an indication of good air quality, and it's not harmful to the plant at all. But it also could be perhaps maybe a canker. Without seeing a picture, it's very hard to describe it. What you could do is send a picture, a digital photo, to the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW-Madison. And the person is Brian Huddleston. He runs the disease diagnostic lab. And picture tells 1,000 words. Without really seeing it, it's kind of hard to tell what it is. But I've seen lichens on the trunks of red maple at the Arboretum, and I think they're pretty. But I don't really know if it's lichens or a canker, so I'd have to send it to Brian.
Yeah, get a shot with your smartphone, get a fairly close up, and
right. And
just email it off to him. There you go. Yeah, thanks, Dan. And Lyle in Montello, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I have got a bluebird hibiscus ordered that should be coming in March, April, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the spot that I want to put it in gets afternoon sun, probably 11:30, and then throughout the rest of the day. And I'm wondering if that would be an okay spot for it, or if it needs all day sun, or what?
It needs as much sun as you can give it.
Hibiscus
okay. are a full sun-only plant.
Okay.
We're talking Rosa Sharon hibiscus. Now, where are you located again in the state?
Montello, just north of Portage.
Okay. Yeah, and that's getting iffy for the species. I had some Rose of Sharon in my yard, and we had a hard winter, was it 6 years ago or so, and it killed mine.
Is there anything I can do to lessen that?
Well, planted in a protected location, for one, the Japanese beetles will absolutely devour your farm.
Oh, I hate them things.
I hate them, too. And that's another reason why I got rid of the hibiscus, because it was like ringing the dinner bell for them. They were just caked on them, on the flowers. It's really
I have some trees in the backyard that they devour, but I have a couple other kinds of hibiscus in the front yard, and they never touched them last year, so I didn't know that was an issue for hibiscus.
Well, Oh yeah, hibiscus are one of their that and roses and grapes are their and raspberries are their favorites.
Okay. Well, they're so beautiful. I can't not try it. So
there you go.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, good luck. Lance in Washburn, your turn. Hi, Lance.
Hello, hello. I'm calling on behalf of my father, Jack, concerning his Asiatic cork trees. He has two massive, massive cork trees on either side of his driveway, and the canopies are just absolutely wonderful. Planted around 1910, so they're very, very large. The canopies are even going over the road now.
Is he in the Washburn area as well?
That is correct, yes.
Okay.
He lives right up the road from me. Uh-huh.
Okay.
And two of the branches, probably 9 inches in diameter, were taken down by a windstorm. And two questions. Should they be cut, and what shall we do with them after, you know, those areas have been cut? Is there something that they should be treated with? And also, what is their life expectancy? Because they're just absolutely stunning trees.
Mm-hmm. It's the Amur cork tree, which is on the DNR NR40 invasive species list, but that's for the females only. Do these produce any fruit?
There's a male and a female.
Yeah.
They're huge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the males are okay to plant, just for our audience knowledge. Females, I would stay away from. In fact, you can't legally plant them anymore in the state of Wisconsin. But the Amur cork tree, since you have a wound, you will have to clean up that wound if it's jagged, obviously. It's not a nice, clean cut. I don't know if you have a chainsaw or would you rather hire a certified arborist to come out and do it for you. If it's higher up in the tree, can't reach it, then I would hire somebody to do it.
Okay.
Don't risk your life. And
No.
Yeah.
I would not use any tree paint or wound compound. Those products do more harm than good. It keeps the area wet underneath the bark. Or underneath the tree paint, it keeps it too moist, and it slows down wound closure. It's cosmetic, and it's not needed. The only time we recommend using tree paint or wound compound is if perhaps you had some storm injury on an oak or an elm tree in the growing season, and you want to cover that up before the picnic beetle or the bark beetle, move into the site of the wound, and they can transfer the fungus within an hour. And after about an hour or two after a wound, then it's pretty much dried up more. But that critical period is when you need to spray it. But other plants, no.
There we go. Thank you so much for calling. And Laura, thank you very much. Look forward to your next visit. Appreciate it very much.
I love doing this.
Laura Zhao, our guest, professor and extension specialist for woody ornamentals in the UW-Madison Department of Horticulture. We'll have her back and we'll do this again. Coming up next week on Garden Talk, Lisa Johnson back to talk about Green Thumb Gardening Series and answer your gardening questions. So I hope you can join us for that. And Monday at this time, our physical therapist will be back to talk about how to safely come back from an injury. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us.